The Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center is studying the spiny water flea, an invasive species spreading through many Minnesota waters. Here to tell us more is Professor Don Brandstrater, one of the researchers and a professor of biology at UMD. Welcome to the Roadhouse, Professor Brandstrater.
Thank you.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about this spiny water flea. What is it?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So it's a type of animal called a freshwater zooplankton, and there's hundreds of species of freshwater zooplankton, and they're all relatively small-bodied. They range from less than a millimeter to maybe 2 to 3 millimeters in length. Some feed on algae, some feed on other zooplankton, so they're carnivores. The spiny water flea happens to be one of those that feeds on other plankton, so we call it a carnivore. And despite its name, so it's a spiny water flea, it's a bit of a misnomer because it's not a flea. In fact, it's not even an insect. But it's kind of interesting to note that the name, it derives from its awkward, kind of jerky swimming motion. And so it kind of resembles a flea when it swims through the water.
But, this is not native to this hemisphere. Where did it come from?
It's not native, no. Well, okay, so nobody knows for certain, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that suggests that it came in the ballast water of ocean-going ships from northern Europe and Asia. And it was first detected in North America in Lake Ontario in 1982. And by 1987, it had spread to all five of the Great Lakes. And its movement within the Great Lakes was probably partly by natural migration, but domestic cargo ships probably were moving it around by ballast tank water as well. And now it's moved. There's about a couple hundred inland lakes in North America, southern Ontario and Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan that harbor infestations.
Oh, my goodness. So there's roughly 40 inland lakes in Minnesota, right?
That's right.
St.
Yeah,
Louis, Lake, and Cook counties?
That's right. Yeah, and it's not only just 40 lakes, but it's 40 of the biggest, kind of most recreationally important lakes. And so, like Lake of the Woods, Rainy Lake, Vermilion, Mille Lacs, Cabotogama, Saginaw, Gunpoint.
Right.
You know, so yeah.
Yep. Okay. So the critter is here. So why is it a problem for Minnesota waters? What does it do? What does it cause as a problem?
Yeah. That's it. Okay. So, well, what makes it unique in terms of a zooplankton is its size. So it's on the big end. It can reach a centimeter in length, and that ranks it among the top, like 1 or 2% maybe, of freshwater zooplankton. And so, but it's still small. So if you had an analogy, like a taxonomic analogy, if this were a mammal, it would be equivalent in size to a grizzly bear, you know, and people would stand up and look around, right, if something that big all of a sudden was on the landscape. But because it's so small, it you know, sort of goes unrecognized. But it also has this long, stiff tail spine, and that's unlike anything we see in the native zooplankton in North America. And so those two kind of attributes, especially that long tail spine, is part of the basis for its impact on food webs. And we're still trying to figure out what these impacts are. We know quite a bit, but there's still a lot to learn. So an aquatic food web, just to sort of maybe give a baseline here, it's a constellation of sort of coexisting species with all sorts of interactions, competition, predation, and so forth and so on. And sometimes when I'm talking with my students, I say, sort of think of it like a chess game, and we have all these different pieces with different roles, and then we plop this new game piece in called spiny water flea, and we don't have a history of, you know, what its role is in the game. There's no rule book or anything, and we want to know what it does. So we wait and watch and sort of let the game play out in one lake after another. And what we're learning, kind of based on that, not just Minnesota lakes, but across North America, is that it has this devastating impact on a whole suite of native freshwater zooplankton. So a good example is in Voyageurs National Park, where the abundance of a group of native zooplankton declined by about 50% within a few years of the spiny water flea invasion. And the concern is that these native zooplankton formerly represented a really important food source and energy source for young fish. So it's basically this strong competitor with young fish. And then to add to the problem, which is, related to the tail spine, and because of that, the young fish can't use it as an alternative food source. They try to consume it, and they sort of choke on it and spit it back out. So it's kind of this energy sort of dead end sink for a lot of native fishes.
What I'm hearing is that the usual food source for little tiny fish, the guys that are just starting out, are exactly the food that these spiny water fleas are eating. So they're eating up the usual food, and they're not really digestible to these little guys.
Well said. That's exactly what's going on. Yeah, they represent this new competitor in the game, but that new competitor doesn't really serve as an alternative food source, at least for the real small fish. Now, once fish hit 3 or 4 inches in length, they can begin to consume spiny water flea, but there's much less biomass of this invader out there than the food that it feeds on. You know, every time, if one trophic level feeds on the next, and only about 10% of the energy and biomass in one trophic level sort of makes it to the next trophic level. Most of that just sort of dissipates as heat and carbon and so forth. And so it's kind of this energy sink is what it is. Yeah.
Hmm. That's problematic. So if we were fishing in a lake that's infested with spiny water flea, would we be able to see them?
Well, that's a really good question. So, because I was also going to mention that one of the nuisance problems with spiny water flea is that the long tail spine ensnares pretty easily on fishing line, and it can actually clog the first inlet. So this long tail spine has these barbs on it that end up just accumulating, allowing the animal to accumulate on fishing lines. And so that's probably the most likely way in which a casual, you know, angler or somebody out there, you know, using downrigging cables or fishing, trolling in particular, would be likely to see it. And you might not see a single individual, but they tend to accumulate in globs on fishing line and work their way down to kind of the terminal tackle right in front of the lure, or as you're reeling line, and they might accumulate on the last eyelet, and that's likely how you would see them.
I was reading a little bit about them in preparation for this interview, and I highlighted gelatinous globs.
Yeah.
That just sounds so unappealing.
It's so unappealing, yeah. But and that's kind of, you know, what you would see first. But if you see one of those globs and you pick it apart, you'll notice that it's a bunch of little individuals, and each one has a stiff tail spine on it. So we're actually going to be out on an area lake this summer, and we're going to try to evaluate which type of recreational gear is most susceptible to accumulation of spiny water flea. We're going to deploy some anchor lines and fishing lines and bait buckets and try to figure out, you know, sort of use that information to refine educational messages to people about where to spend their valuable time cleaning equipment.
Got it.
Yeah.
We're talking with Professor Don Brandstrater. He's a PhD and associate professor of biology at UMD, and he's part of the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center. And right now they're working on spiny water flea. Now, here in Cook County, we've got some pretty popular lakes that are already infested, including Gunflint, Flower, Saginaw, Devil Track, and Trout Lake, and I've got a list of probably a good 8 or 9 more. What can people do when they're fishing to make sure that they're not transporting these little buggers from one place to the next?
Yeah, that's right. The best thing that you can do is to sort of follow the recommended guidelines, which in a fishing manual or the DNR fishing regulations, which basically directs people to clean and drain, and then to also add on top of that dry all equipment that's come in contact with infested waters or any natural waters for that matter. It's interesting. There's a lot of lakes out there that are probably invaded right now that we haven't identified as invaded. We've done some studies to show that there can be a gap of 8 to 10 years, actually, between first arrival and first detection of spiny water flea. So it's kind of smart and good stewardship to do this sort of labor to clean, drain, and dry your equipment, even if you're not on a designated infested lake. But drying, of all of them, I would underscore drying is the number one shield against spiny water flea spread. So if you can thoroughly dry your equipment for at least 6 hours, preferably longer, like overnight or a couple days, it should kill the animal in all of its life stages. So it's got a couple different life stages, one of which is this overwintering resting egg that one would never see unless you had a microscope. But they're the ones, that's the life stage that's probably most resistant to exposure.
So I want to talk about your research in Mille Lacs Lake, but first I want to just say, when I was reading up on this critter, I actually started to have a lot of respect for it.
Yeah.
Because it is so adaptable, and just a couple of things about it. For you mentioned that a couple of ways of reproducing. So it's asexual and sexual reproduction. And part of the deal is when the females are getting stressed, then they start producing more males. They lay these eggs. They float down to the bottom. They can stay there over winter. They actually can be dried out for like 4 hours. So, you pull your anchor out or whatever, and you think you're good. 4 hours later, you go into another lake. Well, guess what? These guys can still sort of rehydrate and get back in the game. And the other thing is that I read that they're actually quite noticeable to other fish. They've got this big black eye, and so what they have is this vertical migration that they do in daylight and dark. So they go down deeper in the water to hide from fish so that there's less light, and then they'll float up at night and eat. So these guys, no wonder they've spread like they have.
Yeah, that's right. They've got a lot of tricks, don't they?
They're
kind of amazing. Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned, that was really nicely summarized there, and that mentioned that the vertical migration is something that they undertake. When we're out evaluating these different pieces of equipment this summer, we're going to do daytime and twilight tests on them, because we sort of have that working hypothesis that nighttime fishing might be a little bit more risky in terms of in the standard spiny water flea, just because they're up in the water column at that time. So, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so given that they're such adaptable and amazing critters, is there hope of containing them or doing something about them? Has your group found anything?
There's nothing available at this point that we know of that can be used to effectively eradicate them, to eliminate them 100% from an ecosystem. They reach different maximum densities in different lakes, and we have some ideas about why that's going on. But even lakes where they're in low densities, we're talking maybe, one animal or two animals per cubic meter. But when you start adding up the volumes of lakes, that's thousands or millions of animals, obviously, in a lake. So there's no means of eradication. So the best thing that we can offer at this point is to just be really vigilant about not infesting new lakes and giving them more opportunities to step their way across the landscape, from one lake to the next.
So now, can we talk about the study that you guys undertook at Lake Mille Lacs near Garrison?
Yeah, you bet. So just to kind of put a little bit of context, most studies that we do with invaders like this are sort of forward-looking. And that's just to say that, an organism like spiny water flea would invade, and then research would commence on that lake. And that's really great. And sometimes there's data available that predate an invasion. And these are the most valuable sorts of opportunities to look at before and after. But what we're trying to do here with this study is sort of the opposite, and do a backward-looking type of study by collecting sediment cores from the lake and reconstructing the story of invasion and changes that happened. And so the way in which we do this is we take these long plastic tubes that are about 4 to 5 feet in length and 3 inches or so in diameter. And we do this in the winter through holes in the ice. The ice tends to be a really good platform to work from. And we push these tubes down into the sediment very carefully, and then suction allows us to draw out about 3 feet of mud. So it's like a tube of cheese, really, but it's mud. And then in the layers of that mud has accumulated or archived, it's amazing, an environmental history of what's been going on in the lake. So there's some chemistry in there that we can use that is nice. And then there's all sorts of what we call subfossils, so bits and pieces and remains of plankton, including spiny water fleas. So the long tail spine is a really nice diagnostic marker of the presence of that organism. And based on the numbers and the presence of those in the sediments, we can tell when they first arrived in a lake. And then we can use subfossil evidence, basically pieces of exoskeleton from its main prey that don't decay, that show up in the sediments. And we can basically piece together what the colonization history and the responses of these lakes. And that's really nice because the Minnesota DNR and other groups have been studying fish populations in these lakes that we're targeting. And I should mention what those are. So it's Lake Mille Lacs and Lake Cabotogama up in Voyageurs National Park. And so with all this long-term data on fish populations, what we want to do is sync that up with our data. And so we have a couple records here to cross-compare changes in the food web that might be relating to spiny water flea and changes in fish populations to try to figure out if we can cause an effect. So spiny water flea comes in, and do we see changes in fish populations? Are there lags in that? These are the sorts of questions that we think we are in a pretty good position to go after.
So are you getting any feeling for, is that one of the big contributors to the walleye issues that Mille Lacs Lake is having?
Yeah, so Mille Lacs Lake is really sick. and some people have said it's sort of a decline or death by a thousand knives. It's not just spiny water flea, but that's there. That invaded, or was first detected there in 2009. But the lake also sustained invasion by zebra mussels in 2005. And then predating that, I would imagine a number of your listeners here are aware, there's been some changes in the water clarity of the lake. The water clarity is improving, and that's been going on for a couple decades now, probably. And that's a signal that there's basically less food at the base of the food chain to eventually make its way up to the top. So there's a number of factors that are changing in Mille Lacs, and that's one reason why with this study we've also chosen Lake Cabotogama, where it has just one stressor of this type, which is spiny water flea. Mm-hmm. And we're also actually going to be out on Lake Winnebogash and Leech Lake as well. And Winnebogash sustained an invasion of zebra mussels in 2012, and Leech Lake is basically clean of any invasion until very recently. Now we have zebra mussels in Leech Lake as well. So those are a couple of control lakes that we'll be looking at. So we'll have a nice distribution of no stressors to sort of maximum stressors in Mille Lacs, if you will.
Lots and lots to study. So
yeah.
Given all of that, what's next for you guys?
Well, so yeah, we've been out on the ice, and the ice is now going away. So we're back in the lab now. We were successful at coring multiple sites in Mille Lacs and in Cabotogama this winter, and now we're back in the lab, and we're extruding the cores. So we're pushing the mud out the top, and we're slicing it off. So we slice it off in half centimeter sections, and then we'll start to study that. We'll start to put it under microscopes and pull out the subfossils, and we'll date that sediment to figure out how old it is at different layers and begin to the nitty-gritty work, but in some ways some of the most exciting work of putting the story together of first presence and these impacts that it's having.
Wonderful. We're talking with Don Brandstrater, and he's with the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center at UMD. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
I don't think so. Sometimes I joke with my colleagues that, you know, we live in this land of 10,000 lakes, and I say, are we heading towards the land of one lake with 10,000 connections? You know, some thinking about keeping spiny water flea and other non-natives out. So we kind of say what we're doing in our lab is trying to prevent that as a new moniker from becoming a reality, you know. So
yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Roadhouse this evening.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Professor Don Brandstrater from the University of Minnesota's Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center.